This is Real Talk, the Customer Insights Show with Christoph Trapp, a top-rated live stream and podcast in the market research and insights industry. We stream live on LinkedIn, Twitter, and YouTube, and you can listen on all major podcast channels and watch on dbtv.tv. Join Christoph and his guests for a weekly discussion around topics that will help you understand your customers better. Real Talk is presented to you by VoxPopMe, the leader in video research for over a decade. Here's today's conversation.
Hello, insights professionals, marketers, and everyone who wants to understand their customers better. I'm Christoph Trapp, your host. And today we want to talk about how do we say goodbye to inefficiencies? Maybe one of my life goals, how do we have better processes? How do we shorten the process with consumer insights? And today's guest, Karen Kraft, we'll bring her on here in a second from Johnsonville. I saw her and her team talk about this exact topic at Quirks Chicago. Fantastic session. And that's why I asked her to come on the show. But how do we do that? We all feel the pressure, right? Shorter time periods. How do we know today? How do we find out? And not just the pressures, but also consumer behavior changes, right? Preferences change. So we can't take a year or two or who knows how long to figure out what's going on. So let's get Karen on the show here and dive into that topic. Welcome, Karen.
Thanks for having me, Christoph.
Now, Karen, if I remember correctly, you're not that far from me, right? Are you in Wisconsin?
Yes, I am in Sheboygan Falls, Wisconsin. More specifically, I am in the middle of a cornfield outside of Sheboygan Falls.
Well, I mean, I can't say I'm in any bigger of a populated area. I'm in Marion, Iowa. And the only reason I ask is my apologies for that Iowa Hawkeyes football helmet behind me, if you even noticed. I know that's Badger country.
I did. And my husband is from Iowa and I didn't grow up in the Midwest. So we are Hawkeye fans. So go Hawks.
Once a hawk, always a hawk. All right. I'm already even happier to have you on the show. So talk about, you guys really shortened the process to figure out what's going on, what's working, what's not working. Kind of walk us through how, first of all, how did that start? And then how does that currently look and why did you get that going?
Well, it started with failure, which a lot of good things come out of failure. And if you learn from it, it only can make things better. And that's what happened in this case. We were in a situation where a lot of our bigger innovations we would develop, start working on, and by the time we showed them to a consumer, which was further down the development pipeline, consumers would be like, wait, this isn't what I envisioned. This isn't what I want. This isn't how it is. So we would have these great concepts that would test wonderfully, and we'd start rapidly developing the product and figure out how we're going to make it. And then by the time we show it to consumers, it was too late. So we worked together, and by we, I mean Consumer Insights and our Product Insights partners over in R&D, worked to develop a process to get consumer feedback earlier so that we could get in consumers' heads and make sure that both us and the consumer understood what everyone's seeing when they read the concept. Because a concept is great, but you can't taste a concept, you can't feel a concept, you can't open a package in a concept. And we realized we needed to get consumers' input much earlier in the process so that we could give our product developers input up front so that they would know exactly what they were developing, so that then when it did come time for a final check, we knew we had a better chance of passing with consumers and say, yep, this is exactly what we want.
You know, I'm always a big fan, of course, to getting that feedback and getting the feedback on an ongoing basis. So when you say earlier, like how early in the process does that happen? And then also we had Teresa Torres on the show and she talks about in her book also the continuous discovery, right? Like you always mm-hmm. keep asking questions. And I don't know what the time frame was that she mentioned. It may have been a week, maybe a month. I don't remember. I shouldn't just make that mm-hmm. number up if I don't remember it. So are you talking about early on, like before you start and then you do it continuously, or how does that look in practice?
So for us, we have a stage gate process. So gate zero is when you have an idea that we've tested a concept with consumers and they like it. And then gate one is our business case. And normally we wouldn't have actual product ready until after gate two, which is where we would which is what we call make one. And so usually we'd be almost halfway through our gate process before we actually had a product that was ready for consumers. So now what happens is when R&D is evaluating concepts that are going through gate zero, if they feel that this is something that is a bigger innovation, so not just a flavor, an incremental flavor that we're developing or an easy line extension, but something that's a really new concept or potentially a new packaging idea, they flag it as something that needs to go through what we call protocepting. So now, instead of developing the business case based off of just some good solid assumptions, we make protocepts of the product, which we may never show them the whole product all in one piece. We might show them different aspects of it and use lots of things in the market that are analogs for it, or even sometimes some of the early protocepts that consumers don't see, but that we evaluate internally might even be not even food. They might be made out of Play-Doh. And that way, when we're going into the business case, we have a solid idea of what we're going to be making, what is going to be required from a consumer standpoint in terms of what does the serving size need to be? How does it need to be packaged? What flavors are we going to be looking to develop? And then we can then make a more solid business case so that everyone knows what is going to happen, and then still go back and check with consumers. But we don't do a lot of, and during the protocepting process, we can't iterate and go back if we don't get it right, or we find that there's attributes that we need more feedback on. But typically, especially because we're developing food, we don't have the opportunity to go back multiple times to consumers along the way. So we do now get feedback up front, and then hopefully just one or two times later, once we've developed the product and potentially the packaging is important.
So interesting. And you know, the one thing I heard you mention really quickly, like in maybe half a sentence, is the importance of, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that's how I heard it. The importance of the relationships, right? You couldn't do it by yourself. You had to mm-hmm. partner with other departments. How important is that to get everybody on the same page? And who all needs to, hate the term, but who all needs to buy in? Who all needs to be on the same page, or at least adjacent pages?
Great question. And yes, it is a team effort. This is not something that is led by Consumer Insights, actually. It's led by R&D. Typically, our project managers in R&D are the ones that kind of guide everyone along. During the different phases, different people take the lead. Consumer Insights and then the brand manager or innovation manager that is championing the project typically only lead the very first phase, which is an alignment phase, where we basically introduce the core team to the idea and here's all the research and all the insights that have gotten us to where it is. And then from that point, our product insights and sensory team take over, as well as our applications team, which is a culinary team led by a chef, that they bring the idea to life, not using necessarily our plants or anything, but sometimes just literally something that can be done in anyone's kitchen, that they bring the idea to life in actual food. And so in addition to all of those people, so we have innovation or brand, consumer insights, product insights and sensory, and our applications team, we then have our product developers as a inform. They're along the way, but they aren't actively working on this. They're there to see how we get to where our output is. And it's critical so that they understand why consumers liked certain things or want certain elements in the product, but they don't have to lead it, so that they can be working on developing products that are further along in the pipeline, and then just know how this one got to where it needs to be, so that they know what is really required and what is just nice to have.
You know, it's another great example of the relationships. How do you work together? Not everybody needs to lead everything. Of course, we had Zoe Dowling, I believe, of Microsoft on the show, and she talked about that at length. So if you want to listen to that episode, you can listen to that anywhere, wherever you listen to podcasts, Real Talk, the Customer Insights show. So, you know, you talked about getting that feedback early on in your protocepting. I always, mm-hmm. Are you the first company that used that term? Did you come up with that?
No, we did not come up with it. It has existed, but we definitely use the words protocept and prototype as two totally different things. Prototype is very real. Protocept might be pretty wonky, but it'll get you enough there to be able to bring an idea to life.
Got it. So prototyping, you have something a little bit more visual, mm-hmm. perhaps a little bit more you can show people, and protocepting is more, hey, here's an idea.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. So when you get the feedback at the beginning, that makes sense. And then when you go back at the end to figure out where things stand and how things have evolved, do you go back to the same group of customers and do they still remember, or do you have just a pool that you draw from? How do you decide who to talk to at the different stages?
Typically at the upfront stage, this is qualitative, done in person, obviously, because of it's food and we want people to taste, smell, and try. And that is done, the two phases may not even be done at the same facility. The first phase, we tend to use facilities that are either in Wisconsin or Chicago so that most of the extended team can actually be there in the back room. Plus, we bring our applications team will bring half of their kitchen from R&D with them because they'll be preparing things. And they're also ready to make things on the fly in between days. So that would be one group of consumers. And typically for those groups, we recruit people that we really see as the core target. Then when we get to the later stages, whether it's a CLT or a home use test or a combination of both, at that point, we're often working with a different supplier, and then also screening people more for just to be concept acceptors. So they may be close to the core target, but it's usually a little bit broader group. So we're really designing for the core. And then if we get everything that they want right, usually then the people that are concept acceptors, we know what they're going to want.
So it sounds like the first part has to be in person because, you know, you want to see how they're interacting with the food, how they try things, yep. their body language. What's different here too, and I think I'm not sure if Nick did this or not, but Nick Graham of Mondelez was on the show before and they asked customers or consumers if they're interested in a mid-target calorie drink. And everybody was like, oh, yeah, we're interested. But he said just the way they said it, nobody believed it, right? And they were correct. Mm-hmm. They were like saying, yes, we want it. But at the end of the day, they didn't want it, but they were mm-hmm. trying to be nice. How do you get around those kind of things to make sure you get their true feelings or true opinions and not the people pleaser kind of respondents, if that makes sense?
Well, a lot of times our core target, you know, have to be in the category if it's something that we're in, they have to say that, yes, I buy in this category. And typically our moderator, the first thing off the bat, kind of rescreens them both in the waiting room as well as in the room to make sure everybody is there and is, you know, is the right target. And we have had to excuse people because we realized, oh, they don't, you know, they have someone that's a vegetarian in the household and we didn't want anyone that was a vegetarian, or they don't participate in this category and they somehow made it through. But for the most part, the companies we work with do a good job of screening. We did have one project where it involves, you know, we were looking for people that did a certain kind of behavior and the way we described it. And I can't describe it any more in detail because it's confidential, but the way we described what this activity that they participated in and how they described it were two totally different things. And the good thing is luckily, even though not everybody was the core target in the groups, we did have a few people from in each group that were the core target. And even the people that were a little bit further out, I would say probably about one or even two rings out, were interested in the product, but we didn't even expect them to be interested as interested in it as they were. So they could give us still good feedback.
It's always kind of a fine line to figure out who should be included, you know, and then also how do you move that conversation forward, of course, based on how they behave, how their facial expressions, body language, and whatnot. You know, one thing we talk about quite often, I know you mentioned that in your session, is to be consumer-centric. And I'm always interested. We love a good definition here on Real Talk, and we've heard several, but give us your definition of being consumer-centric and why is that important?
Okay, I think the reason that this whole project existed because we weren't consumer centric. So when we start a project that goes through our IPR process or innovation process review, one of the first forms that has to be filled out is called a four box. And it basically lays out what's required, what's desired, what would be tolerated, and what would be what needs to be avoided for this project to come to life. Before we started this process, we typically would do a concept test, and between what existing consumer insights we had and then what the brand manager and innovation manager felt, they would fill the four box out. And sometimes there's things in there that are definitely things that we need to think of, like we want the cost of goods to are required under a certain amount of money, or it's good, we really want this to be able to be done in-house, so we're going to put that in the desired box, that we're not going to use we really don't want to use a co-packer, etc. The problem is we quickly learned that what we think the consumers want and what consumers actually want are two different things. So now consumer centricity is listening to the consumer and putting those things in on that four box. So we developed what we call key consumer attributes. And key consumer attributes are, if you think about a thing and you know anything and you want to bring it to life, what are the things that the consumers want to be true? Like how thick should it be? How tender should it be? How sweet or sour, depending on whatever the concept is. And listen to the consumers, don't make assumptions ourselves, and develop to what they want, not us. Because as my coach at Johnsonville says, and that's what we call our bosses, not coaches, they're not managers, they're coaches, is if you're going to buy $700 million of sausage, fine, we'll listen to you. But if not, we're not listening to you, we're listening to the consumer. So that's why when we develop new products, if you're going to buy every single one of these, fine, innovation manager, you can dictate exactly what it's going to be like. But my guess is you're not going to buy every single new product that we produce. So we need to listen to the people that are going to buy it, not to you.
Yeah, it's kind of a fine line. You know, as you were talking too, I was also thinking about if I'm thinking about Johnsonville brats, like I like them, I eat them, but I couldn't tell you what I would do. What innovation I would even appreciate. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Would I like them better if they're thinner? I don't know, maybe not, or whatever. But so how do consumers, I mean, is it really, how do they know what they might like or what they might not like? Or is it truly just like gut reaction? You show them something and they're like, this is a really good idea. Or they say, oh, I don't get it.
Well, using the same example that I used at Quirks, we were developing what we have now launched in test market here in the upper Midwest called Double Better with Cheddar. So Better with Cheddar is our number one selling smoked sausage SKU, yet we consistently would get complaints through our complaint line that there's some people that think there's not enough cheddar in it. So we could have done the easy thing and just doubled the amount of cheese in it, said, hey, we're done. But we explored that not all things that are double are actually just double. So for example, our R&D team, we bought a bunch of things that claim double or extra or mega or ultra and took those things apart and weighed them. And fun fact, there is not double the stuff in a double stuff Oreo. It is more, but it's not exactly double. And we realized that if we really wanted to figure out what does double better with cheddar mean, we needed to show consumers. So one of the many things that we, out of all of the different attributes that we tested with that, some were size, some were shape, you know, should it be bigger? Should it be fatter? Should it be longer? We also did play with the amount of cheese. And we learned that you can put too much cheese in a better with cheddar sausage. So we, not only did we serve people double, but internally we tasted all the way up to 6 times the cheese, which actually became quite disgusting. And we didn't show consumers that, but we showed them all the way up to 4 times the cheese so that we knew when we crossed that line. And then we determined the amount. Plus we also played with the type of cheese. Should it be shredded? Should it be cubed like it currently is? Should it be 2 different types of cheese? So it looks like there's white cheddar and yellow cheddar in it. So the way we get into consumers' heads, because consumers can't articulate it, is we think of all the different possibilities and then literally show them and often have them taste them so that they can then tell us what they like. So that's part of the protocepting process and why we try to do them locally is because we have so many samples, plus we have raw materials on hand, so that if we come up with even another option, or a consumer suggests another option, we can literally make that product and have it ready for them, the next group of consumers, the next day.
I mean, mind blown. There is such a thing as too much cheese. Unbelievable. But very interesting how you test it. The one thing I wanted to circle back on, I kind of got distracted a little bit thinking about brats here, quite frankly. But you talk about your company wasn't consumer centric. And I think that's actually very commendable, right? To figure that out and then to move forward better. But, and I think there's a lot of companies out there, they think they might be customer centric or consumer first or whatever they want to call it. And maybe they're not. But how do you actually figure that out? And not just one person, but how does the team figure that out? Is there some kind of tip or advice you can give companies who might think they're doing it, but they're not?
I think the way we figured it out is literally by when we realized that our assumptions, you know, when we were making assumptions and then later checking in with consumers and it wasn't working. And a lot of it has to do with, we're a family owned company owned by the son of the founder. And he is, you know, he's now in his late 70s. His wife is the chairman of the board and chairwoman of the board, and his several of their kids and even the next generation beyond that are starting to work, are working or starting to work here at the company. So the family has a lot of say. However, and it, the original recipes and everything for our core products were based on recipes that the founder of the company brought with him from Austria. So there's a lot of inherent sausage knowledge. However, the more we get away from our core products, that's as we start to innovate and we're not in things that we used to, that we've done for 75 plus years, that's where we realized, okay, we're getting out of our lane of expertise, and now we really need to understand what consumers are buying. Because when it comes to bratwurst, we didn't ever protocept brats. We probably never will. We know exactly how to make the best tasting brat in the country, and that is something we can do in our sleep. However, as we're doing new things that we haven't done for decades, that's where it really, we realized, okay, now we have to listen, because just relying on our gut isn't working.
Yeah, just relying on our gut, that's, but some people do certainly do that. So it's always good to remember that that's not necessarily the way to do it. When you talk to customers, I know you mentioned you like to do it locally. Is there no difference geographically? Like, is it necessary sometimes to talk to other people, or is it just the general, is it similar across the country, whether you talk to people in Wisconsin or Chicago or Phoenix?
So far, for most of the projects that we've done, we have done locally. However, for example, there was a project where we were developing a product for the Northeast, and we needed to, you know, talk to experts in Italian sausage in the Northeast, and that's a very competitive area and things. We actually, instead of consumers, we took our product and sampled it with brokers. Obviously, for that, we didn't send the army that we normally do, and we couldn't change things on the fly since it was a single meeting with several brokers, but we still walked them through the tasting and had them give feedback so that we could then take that feedback back to the headquarters and make some decisions based on that session. For the most part, for a lot of our categories, being, especially if they're sausage related, being in the upper Midwest, it's a good place to be because this is where a lot of sausage is bought. But as we go into other categories, there may be times where we need to go to the South or the West Coast, depending on what category we're trying to innovate into. But so far we haven't had to, but we can.
I'm not going to disagree with you there, Karen. We in Iowa here know what a good sausage is supposed to taste like. Now, do you ever do any testing when it comes to marketing or packaging or advertising or those kind of things? Do you tie that into the process as well, or not as much?
We've actually done entire protocepting process projects specifically on packaging. So we have an idea already, and we've we know what the formulation is going to be like, but we need to understand how consumers want it packaged. So in that case, instead of the R&D product developers, we work with our packaging engineers, who often then work with their suppliers to come up with protocept packages, some that actually work, some that don't. And again, we have a great moderator that can, you know, get feedback from consumers. In terms of marketing and advertising, probably the closest that we do is sometimes we'll talk about positioning. How does this fit into your life? What would you tell people about this? And we might even have some different positioning statements that people react to if we're really still trying to figure out how this concept is going to fit into their lives. Because our moderators do always start with the concept before we show them anything, so that we can understand what are people expecting, what feedback do they have for us, and what else is, sorry, I'm distracted. My light went off. I need to wave my arm there. Thank you.
I don't know what happened.
Yeah, it was weird. I was like, what's going on? And I realized I've been too still. But just generally, we don't get into like specific advertising and things in these sessions, because a lot of times that's going to come later. But we might get some ideas on what messages might be relevant.
You know, the whole advertising testing is interesting to me too. We had Thomas Ware on the show. Have you seen those, the Liberty Mutual insurance commercials? They're kind of, I call them wacky, mm-hmm. like in front of the Statue of Liberty. And some people said they will never work. People will not like them, but their testing shows that people overall love them, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so that's why they keep doing them, because their testing just comes back very, very positively. Now I lost my train of thought because I was thinking about their commercials. Maybe it comes back to me. Maybe as the final question here is, how do you ensure that what the customers actually mean is what you're hearing? And then how do you make sure it gets implemented? I think this was Nick Graham who mentioned this from Mondelez, the Henry Ford quote, right? About if you would have asked people, blah, 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 what they wanted, they would have said faster horses. And everybody says you can, don't do research because that's what it means, or don't talk to customers. And he said, of course, there's an insight in that quote. They don't know what a car is, but they certainly told you they want to go faster. So how do you make sure you hear the right thing? And then how do you kind of tie it into the implementation?
I think that's actually before we even get to the concept stage. We do a lot of different types of foundational research, whether it's ethnographies, in person or online jobs to be done work, where we listen to what consumers' problems are and we read through the tea leaves to exactly see that, you know, they want to go faster. And then we come up with all the way ideas, and sometimes we work with consumers to help us come up with ideas. Sometimes our ideations are completely internal. And when we do work with consumers, we work with creative ones, so that we can come up with lots of different ideas to screen, and then see, okay, which one of these ideas hit on that pain point or that job. A lot of times we would never ask people directly, hey, what do you want? In the case of the double better with cheddar, literally they were saying, it was a subset of consumers that were saying, we want more cheese. So that was a pretty easy one. Most of them aren't that easy. Most of them were trying to solve a bigger problem. That one just happened to be really easy. But yeah, most of the time, they're not going to tell us exactly what they want. They're just going to tell us the problem that they're having, or sometimes just show us the problem that they're having. And they don't even realize it's a problem until we watch them struggle with a package or have some workaround that they don't even realize they're doing.
Yeah, it's certainly about active listening and active paying attention, for lack of a better term. Karen, really appreciate you coming on the show. Thanks for sharing your insights and making the time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Thanks everyone for watching and listening. I'll be back on Friday with another episode with Gia Lotti. Her new book on how to run a customer-led strategy is now available for pre-order. See you then.